Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for August 23rd, 2015. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
Good to have y'all. And tonight we're going to try to line up an hour show. And then Lowell Feld's going to be our guest about 7:20. We're going to try this thing again. Good news is it usually doesn't take us two times to get it right, but this time hopefully we will get it right in two times. So looking forward to have Lowell on the show talking about Virginia politics here in a little bit. But until then, we're going to do something that we sort of do every week but hadn't done in a while. That's talk about the presidential race. Do that most every week, but we never seem to talk about the Democratic side because the Republican side seems to have, you know, just sucked up all the oxygen. And it seems like this week with Joe Biden making more moves, if you will, than he has really throughout this process, it really was the most noteworthy week in quite a while for the 2016 Democratic nomination. Tim, would you agree with that assessment that this week seemed to actually have a bit of a Democratic race unlike previous ones?
Yeah, with the talk beginning now about a possible run by the vice president, we're starting to see some more stories on the Democratic side. Now, I, of course, don't know if he's going to run. I believe it's late November. He's going to be 73 years old. But, you know, at that age, you might be thinking, well, why not? I mean, there's there's not going to be a future run, you know. This is it. This it'll be this year or next year, rather, or no year. Plus, if he went ahead and announced, I guess he'd already be in the race and in good position in case Clinton drops out or implodes or something. And he's in the team, so in the national polls right now. I just don't know. It is interesting he's having these quiet little meetings with Elizabeth Warren, though, this weekend, ain't it?
Yeah, I mean, that was, I guess, kind of the newest news, if you will. Catherine, there seems to be some possible motivations for this thing. Some people say that it was his son Beau's, you know, dying wish, if you will, for his father to give it one more try. He, of course, ran in 88, ran in 2008, and this might be the clearest of those three fields because, of course, the other two times there were so many people running. And then other folks may say that, you know, of course, the poll numbers have not been as good as they have in previous weeks for Hillary Clinton. What do you think the motivations are?
I think that's the motivation, is the some concern about, excuse me, about Senator Clinton's or Secretary Clinton's poll numbers and favorability at this point, and lack of another really viable Democratic candidate in the field. So I would say that's probably the motivation. I guess my inclination would be, instead of thinking about running, perhaps he could try to help Secretary Clinton bolster her number.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I guess, you know, people are saying, well, the email server thing may finally get some traction. And they pointed to some Quinnipiac numbers in some swing states that were the worst numbers I've seen, although I want to see other sources before I believe that those polls are accurate within themselves. Now, if you showed me three of the pollsters that polled Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Florida and showed her losing possible matchups in all three of those states, Pennsylvania was kind of the most shocking, then I might begin to believe there's more there. But those numbers by themselves could be an outlier. Tim, I know you follow the polls as closely as any of us. Did you see the Quinnipiac polls, and what did you make of them?
I did, and you're right. That one poll by itself, look, if Democratic presidential candidate is going to lose Pennsylvania, we're going to get thumped in the election. Pennsylvania, especially in recent elections, has been fool's gold for the Republican, and it's one of those states that the Democrats have won at least six elections in a row, part of that blue wall. I'm not too worried about that, but there's no doubt that Secretary Clinton's numbers have slipped some this summer. She'd been on vacation, and she's left her vacation to go back on the campaign trail. So I think there's a little concern in their campaign, but we know what the Republicans are doing. They're going to attack her 24/7 because they know what the polls do say. She runs as the nominee, she probably wins. And if she's not the nominee, then that gives them a great chance to win. So, of course, they want anybody but her in the race. Because really, the Democratic bench right now is pretty thin all of a sudden, ain't it?
Yeah, and that's something I think that people pointed to just looking at, you know, Senate races and things like that. Although there are more folks, I think, to pull that on. It's just they're not running for president.
Well, I mean, look at the youth poll on the Republican side. The 40-year-olds and stuff like that are suddenly over on the Republican side of this presidential race. And, you know, I still figure it's got to be Secretary Clinton or nobody. I love Joe Biden. I really do. I see no way he can win.
Well, I mean, that's like, I mean, I'm just saying if, and I don't think there's any good reason. I think the email server thing, you know, emerging technologies and email and things like that, they're still fleshing themselves out what the exact proper protocol is. I think if somebody were to do this 30 years from now, it may be different because people have understood the technology better. But at this point, it's kind of a new thing. But if Hillary Clinton were to drop out, Kirsten Gillibrand, senator that pretty much replaced her in New York, that would be a candidate that would be much more youthful, fit what we're trying to do on our side. So, I mean, I don't think our bench is completely gone. It's just, it's not as deep as it should be by any means. And we've got to work on that over the next, hopefully, 8 years by 2024. We can't run an 80-year-old. I mean, we'll have to have created some new people by then. But now let's just say that Joe Biden gets in this race. I think this could in some ways help the Democrats because the Republicans, just their race has taken up all the media's attention. You know, of course, then the people are watching that because that's where the action is. And maybe some of those swing voters or what have you, the intensity, people are starting to think more about Republicans and, oh, that's what the choices are. And the Democratic side is the inevitability of Hillary Clinton. Maybe if it was a little bit in question and then folks could follow a race, it might actually help the Democrats in the general. Catherine, is there any validity to that strain of thought?
The thing that worries me about a Biden run is that I think it just like puts a lot of scrutiny about his time. Like, is he traveling as a candidate? Is he traveling as a vice president? I think there'll be a lot more scrutiny of that. And it's like a whole meme that the media and the right can use, like, oh, he's not really serving as vice president. He's a candidate. Why, you know, I think there's, I mean, I agree that it will put more attention on the Democratic side. I'm just not so sure that attention is good.
Yes. Tim, there has to be one Democrat that is probably not looking forward to Joe Biden running, even though he may never, ever admit it, even in private, much less in public. And that's President Obama, because I get the sense that he still has that guilt being, you know, I mean, his whole world, I mean, his grandmother, his mother, his wife, his daughters. I mean, I still feel there's some kind of guilt there that he did stop the first female president. Now, of course, he couldn't make history otherwise. But then he I guess if he can somehow support Hillary Clinton and she becomes president, then some of that goes away. But then if Joe Biden runs and she doesn't get her chance, at no telling how much longer the first female president gets pushed into the future, could even then conceivably be a Republican somewhere down the road instead of a Democrat. Do you think these are reasons that Barack Obama would just rather Joe Biden not run?
Boy, he would be walking a thin little tightrope, wouldn't he, the president? He's got his vice president running and his former Secretary of State running. The person I think that would least look forward to the vice president, though, entering the race is Bernie Sanders. See, there's already an alternative candidate to Hillary Clinton. This can't help Bernie Sanders if the vice president runs, because that's the vote he's going to take away, is the vote that's gravitating to Bernie Sanders. Those that are going to vote for Secretary Clinton are pretty well already locked in. I know that, you know, I love Joe Biden, but I wouldn't switch my vote now if he were to get into the race. I don't think Bernie Sanders would like this at all. Remind me of 1968 when McCarthy knocked Johnson out and then Kennedy jumped in the race after, you know, something like that.
Yeah, and then talking about Bernie Sanders, to me it seems like in the last few weeks he's kind of lost traction, and I don't know if it has or hadn't, but it seems like it possibly coincided with the Black Lives Matters group jumping on stage when he was making speeches. Was that coincidental?
No.
Bernie
Sanders was this media sensation. Well, guess who swooped in and took up all the air in that room? A fella on the other side of the aisle. And candidates like Bernie Sanders can't get a word in edgewise now because all of a sudden the new media sensation is not him anymore, and the big crowds he's getting, it's Donald Trump. So I think that's what's happened to Bernie Sanders. He's lost his coverage to him, as has several of the candidates.
I will say this. I support Hillary Clinton fully, but I almost feel sorry for Bernie Sanders when people jump up and protesters jump up in the middle of his speech, because honestly, that can't happen to Hillary Clinton. You know, if a bunch of people wanted to jump on stage with her, there'd be a group called the Secret Service that would put that down. And now if Joe Biden runs and they tried to do that, him being vice president, the Secret Service would, you know, toss them off. And Bernie Sanders, of course, doesn't have that protection, if you will.
That's true.
He's just a senator. So I do think he gets put in a bad situation because the other two, you know, and I guess that group knows. I mean, yeah, we will look kind of different, or maybe they'll get some martyrdom if they did that. Try that with Hillary Clinton, but I guess they know they're not going to be as successful, as you will. Mm-hmm. Well, while we get a little time, let's switch back over to the other aisle, and it won't be Donald Trump right now. We'll go to something else. And another story came out on the Duggars. And I guess Josh is the main one. Well, and I'm not, I don't laugh. And how you're saying, how is this not Gawker material and how is this political, even though it's covered pretty well in Gawker? But there's this Ashley Madison thing, the website that feed on your significant other. And this Duggar fella has gotten caught into this web. He already had the other controversy. Well, the reason I bring this up in political circles is the Duggars are kind of the celebrity endorsers of Mike Huckabee. And Mike Huckabee, I don't think anybody would say he's doing as near as well as he did in 2008. And there's almost some kind of parallel. I don't think people are maybe seeing what the Duggars do and then saying, I don't want to vote for Huckabee this time. But it seems like he's really just somehow negatively tied in some way, even on a more subconscious level, with these Duggars and this guy that is just, he doesn't walk his talk. Let's just, you know, say it that way. And Kevin, how much of a link do you think that there is there between the poor Huckabee campaign and this Josh Duggar, this I'm looking for the right word disaster, if you will.
Well, I don't know if there. I don't know if it's a direct connection, but I do think that I think people are growing tired of some of the, you know, Huckabee's this sort of Christian. I mean, I know there's still a lot of people. Don't get me wrong. I know there's still a lot of people that buy into the values that he talks about. But I think sometimes when you see this, you know, wealthy, successful, somewhat hypocritical guy trying to gain leverage from those values, I think that the Duggar thing just feeds into the sort of lack of authenticity that Huckabee, and that was Huckabee's big strength 4 and 8 years ago, was that he was very authentic. But I think he's lost that authentic sheen. I think he looks just like every other opportunist now.
Yeah, and I think that the thing is, there is obviously, I mean, I'll use somebody else that's kind of famous with their Christianity, Tim Tebow. From what we understand about Tim Tebow, you know, he is much more authentic. I mean, he walks his talk, whereas, you know, this Josh Duggar, I mean, he seems to want to use it to get attention and get these new spots and these conservative groups, and he has his show, but then you look at his past, and he's just out of control. And this, you know, he doesn't practice what he preaches.
I mean, he admitted this week that he was a hypocrite.
Well,
he said,
yeah,
it in a conference. I mean,
this came up back when the Michael Vick thing, and I can't remember if I said it on this show or I said it otherwise. Was he sorry because he did it, or was he sorry he got caught? I think it's applicable here with Josh Duggar. Was he sorry he did it, or was he sorry he got caught? I'm pretty sure on the second one. Maybe he is sorry on the first one. I don't know his heart. I can't know his heart, but I definitely believe he's sorry on the second one. And that's why I think a lot of people may be wondering about him.
I'm sorry. I just have to say this. I can't believe people are so stupid that they sign up for these websites. They don't even go and get like a Hotmail account and, you know, try to cover it up. They're like, you know, all these government email addresses that they discovered. I mean, I just don't get it.
Catherine, before I get Tim to comment on this situation, when can people hear the podcast, Catherine, on the down low, where you give them all the tips? Okay, just kidding. I don't think that podcast exists. Josh Duggar does it, not Catherine, in fact. Tim, make some comments on this.
I'm always proud when frauds get exposed. I don't think his connection to Governor Huckabee is hurting Mike Huckabee. He's got several problems this year aside from that. And one, he is really staggering all over. I'm sure both of you have seen it on the news. It's the issue of, like, gays in the military, gay marriage. I mean, obviously, since he ran before, that ship has sailed right past him.
Yeah.
And he's a niche candidate, and it's just pounding him, and it's pounding him in his poll numbers. I just think he's dead in the water, and he's just the social issues are beating several of them up this year because they're frankly on the wrong side of them, and on the wrong side of the American people, which is even worse. So when a majority of Republicans are for something that you're opposed to and you're running as a Republican, you got a problem, right?
Yeah, and I think policy-wise, I'm sure we mentioned it. It was the 10-year-old young lady from Latin America and Mike Huckabee, you know, against abortion in all situations.
Yeah.
And I think 90, somewhere in the 90s would be against Mike Huckabee's stand. They're probably poll numbers to stacks out there somewhere, but I would just guess it's around there. Well, it's about 20 minutes in, like we promised. We delivered this week. Welcome back to the Kudzu Vine for the umpteenth time from Blue Virginia, Mr. Lowell Feld.
Hey, how you doing?
Oh, good. You got me nervous with that pause, Lowell. I'm like, the board's showing one thing, but my audio's not delivering. All right. Well,
yeah, I wasn't sure. Are you guys? You don't know about this technical difficulties thing here, but okay, we're live, right?
We're live.
We're here today.
Going through. Yeah, we're going for a whole hour. We've got
okay.
Guest. We're back on track. A 1 week hiccup, hopefully. But we learned a lesson. And but Lowell, we wanted to have you on and talk about Virginia because obviously Virginia is the biggest state in the Beltway. And of course, you have the District of Columbia. But I think Virginia is just right there in all that. And you have one of the presidential candidates. You have two of the presidential candidates, but let's start on the Democratic side. Jim Webb kind of jumped in, and that may be the last thing I heard from him, but I'm not following his campaign as closely as you will. What's going on with Jim Webb's campaign?
Ouch. Ouch. Jim Webb's campaign, good question. He actually was on CNN State of the Union this morning, so he has been appearing on the Sunday talk shows, but yeah, I mean, it's a strange campaign. I mean, you've got a campaign that the Washington Post, The Fix, I don't know if you ever read that thing, but the other day they were mocking it for never talking to the media. And apparently, this is a presidential campaign that doesn't believe in talking to the media almost at all. Also, barely been to Iowa or New Hampshire. I don't know what on earth, Well, of course, I worked for Jim Webb in campaign in 2006 for U.S. Senate, and he wasn't a big fan of politics in general. He wasn't a big fan of raising money. He still isn't. He wasn't a big fan of campaigning. I think it's fair to say he still isn't. And he, doesn't have any money, really, very little money. He doesn't have a super PAC for him, like a lot of candidates have these super PACs. He's said he's decried the influence of money in politics, which is all great, but you still need money to pay the staff and to, to communicate with voters. So, he's polling in 1% or whatever. I think in Iowa he's around 1%, in New Hampshire 1%. He hasn't moved. In months, as far as I could tell. I think he might have popped up to like 2 or 3% at one point and fell off back to 1%. So, yeah, going nowhere fast, kind of. I actually was interviewed by the Huffington Post in July. They did an article talking about how a lot of Jim Webb supporters from 2006, some of his most passionate, diehard, whatever supporters are not supporting him this time. And, I explained why I'm not supporting them this time. I think probably speak for some others too, but one thing is, to me it's a huge issue is climate change and more broadly the environment, clean energy, energy policy, and he's just terrible on that. Just there have been a bunch of articles written about he's just awful when it comes to environmental issues and energy issues. He seems to be a big fan of coal, even though he wrote in his book Born Fighting, he bashed the coal industry, but apparently something changed. And he's been bashing the Democratic Party, which I find an odd strategy for someone trying to win the Democratic nomination. Usually you don't bash the people you're trying to like persuade to vote for you, but claiming that this is the weird thing. He said the Democratic Party went too far to the left. But what he was talking about, I think, was about economic populism and this sort of concept that, the rich are getting richer and all. This is stuff he's been talking about and writing about since 2006. I'm like, wait a minute. If you think the Democratic Party's gone too far to the left, then I guess you've gone too far to the left, too, because, in fact, you were too far to the left in 2006 and because you've been talking about this stuff forever. So it's very strange. I don't really understand that campaign. A lot of the people who worked for him in 2006, almost none of them are working for him this time. So it's odd. I don't think I just don't see him gaining traction. I don't see what his path to, you know, getting anywhere in Iowa or New Hampshire would be, or anywhere else for that matter, in the Democratic primary. I mean, remember, these electorates for the Democratic primary are progressives. They're very liberal, whatever you want to say. They're very, you know, they're to the left. I mean, you know, the people that he just bashed, I mean, like in Iowa or whatever. So it's also weird, by the way, you know, people, some people think for some reason, just because Jim Webb opposed the Iraq war, they think he's anti-war. Well, that's just not true. I mean, you know, this is a guy who still to this day supports the Vietnam War. And yeah, and he also opposes the Iran deal. He's spoken out against the Iran nuclear deal multiple times now, which I think the alternative to that is not good. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
So the concept that Jim Webb's an anti-war candidate, that's not correct. So that's just a short version of my feelings about Jim Webb.
Well, it sounds like, I mean, you know, you put aside his shortcomings as a candidate as far as raising money and actually getting into the states where the voters are, but just his, the way, like the segment of the party he's running for or towards or what have you, seems like he's like a 1988 style candidate that thinks he's going to do well in the South on the old Super Tuesday kind of deal. And that's just so many cycles ago. Do you get that sense that it's kind of like this campaign might have worked 20, 25 years ago?
I mean, not even then, really.
you still have to have a competent campaign.
You still have – you always have to have a strong campaign, though. Yeah, maybe more than today, but – I'm just not sure what niche of the party he's running. What is his market, you know, opportunity sort of like? Is there a market for what for a Jim Webb? What would it be? I mean, if he was running as like let's say 8 years ago, he was the anti-Iraq war candidate. Okay, all right, I can sort of see that. And back then, if he was running on an economic populist and anti-Iraq war platform, I mean, you could see it at least to some extent. This time, I mean, if he runs as an economic populist, I mean, Bernie Sanders already has that one covered, I think, pretty well. Not sure how he gets to the left of Bernie Sanders exactly, or more populist than that. And actually, Hillary Clinton has been much more economically populist this time around than she was 8 years ago. I mean, she's just not that far in some ways from, you know, where Webb is or even Sanders in some ways. So but you know, you have to, you still have to raise money. You have to communicate with voters. You have to campaign. You have to do, I mean, you just have to. I mean, and if you don't do that, I don't see whether it's 1988, 98, 2008, whatever year. I mean, I don't see how you, you know, Super Tuesday is going to be a bunch of states on that day. It's going to take millions and millions of dollars to communicate your, you know, your message to get to break through in all those states. So I don't know how he can do that.
Yeah, it's kind of sad when you have a guy running for president, and if you were to given the book How to Win Elections, the old manual from about 30 years ago, even run for local office, it would be a revelation to him. I mean, I don't know if Lawrence Gray, the judge, wrote it, and it was a big deal way back when, but politics moved on. But it sounds like he's not even following the simple lessons of that book. Well, I'm going to go and pass this over to Tim, ask away about questions. Catherine will do some more. We'll keep going around. Tim?
Yeah, well, one of my first questions, Lowell, was going to be, why in the world is Jim Webb doing this? I mean, listed off a bunch of things that are just, well, they don't really make any sense. And, you know, he's been around a while. He's got to see the same polls that we see. He knows he doesn't have any money. He knows these things. Why such a quixotic thing is this when he has no chance at all?
I mean, you know, I can't read his mind, but and I'm not going to try to look into his heart like Bush did with Putin or whatever. You saw how that worked out.
Yeah,
but anyway,
right.
I think, you know, that worked out great. It sounds kind of corny, but I think to the extent I know Webb, and I think I know him pretty well, and I've read a lot of what he's written and everything, I think he really believes in duty and honor, and that he and he's very patriotic, and I mean, that's not all, you know, BS or whatever. I think he really believes that. He also and I think he really feels that the country is in a tough situation right now, and it needs, this is the second part, it needs his leadership. He's got a big ego. I mean, he thinks he's brilliant. I'm sure he does, and he is a very smart guy, there's no question. And you know, he thinks that he offers something. He brings something to the table as a veteran, as a former, you know, Navy secretary and everything. I mean, and just his whole life experience. He really thinks he has something to offer, and he thinks he has a economic philosophy that needs to be articulated. Although, I think the economic populism is kind of covered by Sanders and to some extent Clinton, but on foreign policy, he definitely feels that he's an expert in that, although I'm not sure how he's more of an expert than the former Secretary of State, but okay, I guess we could see how that plays out in the debates, but you know, it's also going to be interesting to hear him try to defend this opposition to the Iran deal, but anyway, I think he believes that he has something to offer, that you know, that maybe he thinks that at some level that there'll be an opening for him at some point. Maybe other candidates will stumble, and you know, there are a lot of these people. There's a joke about, I think it's about mostly the Senate, but these senators, every one of them wakes up in the morning, looks in the mirror, and sees a president, a future president, you know, in the staring back at them. I mean, I think there's some truth to that. So honestly, other than that, not being able to read his mind, it's hard to say. I mean, I've heard people speculate that he's trying to run. He's running for a cabinet position or a vice president. I don't buy that. That I don't believe, because 8 years ago he was apparently the Obama people wanted to vet him, quote unquote, vet him for, you know, do background checks and everything on him for to be possibly considered as their running mate, as Obama's running mate in 2008, and he declined. He said no thanks. So I find that hard to believe. And then and cabinet, I don't think he'd run for president just to get in the cabinet. I just don't think that's what makes him tick. But anyway, I can't read the guy's mind.
Yeah. Well, since you are Lowell Field from Virginia, I would like to turn my attention to the state of Virginia with my next question. And it's for the benefit of our listeners, just a few short years back, and I mean a precious few, as you know, to even consider that the state of Virginia might be anything other than reliably rock-ribbed Republican was, it was unthinkable, I guess. Obviously now that is not the case. Could you give a brief rundown for our listeners of what exactly happened to change that in that state?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we've probably discussed this before, but just briefly, I mean, I think one thing that happened was Virginia's population demographics have changed a tremendous amount over the last few decades. There's been a huge influx of just new people moving into the state. The fastest growing parts of Virginia and the most economically vibrant parts of Virginia are very diverse. Lots of Latinos, Asian Americans, lots of what people coming from the Northeast, white people, whatever people coming from other parts of the country and settling in the D.C. metropolitan area, settling down in the Hampton Roads area, which is a heavy naval base and port, and Virginia Beach is down in that area, and then in Richmond, and the areas of the state that have been strongly red are the more rural areas of the state. Their population has been stagnant, basically, or even in some cases shrinking. So I think a lot of it is demographics. I think, you know, Virginia, I don't think was ever, you know, I mean, it's changed so much, it's hard to even compare. I mean, remember, it used to be Dixiecrat, which was, and a lot of the southern states were, they were democratic, but they were very conservative, and, you know, you had a whole group of Dixiecratic electeds like Jesse Helms and, you know, well, of course, George Wallace and other people. But the so that's changed, and it took a while to sort all that out as the parties sorted themselves out. But yeah, I mean, and then I think in the other, we've had some races where, you know, you've had a unique set of circumstances too. Like in 2006, when Jim Webb won that Senate race, I mean, that was a wave election year nationally for Democrats. George Allen ended up kind of imploding to some extent, and we only won by a few thousand votes. So, you know, let's not get too carried away with this. And then in 2013, we swept the three statewide elected offices, governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general, but not by that much. I mean, we're talking about a few points, and against a really extreme Republican ticket that they nominated at a convention after basically forcing out the lieutenant governor, who's a more mainstream Republican, basically forced him out. He wanted a primary, and Ken Cuccinelli, the extremely, extremely conservative former attorney general of Virginia, had the forces on the state Republican Central Committee to force him out. So basically, the Republicans have moved to the right, and the state has changed demographically, and the growing groups are mostly heavily Democratic. And so, you know, you put all that together, and you end up with Democratic victories, but not by, like, landslides. I mean, in 2014, Mark Warner, who's the most popular politician in Virginia, won. He beat Ed Gillespie, the former chair of the Republican National Committee, et cetera, et cetera. But only by, like, less than a point, you know.
But it's a purple state. Yeah, a quick question, and then I'll throw it over to Catherine. Is it fair at least to say, though, that Virginia is now the most progressive of the southern states?
Well, I think Virginia at this point is the only southern state where all three of the top statewide offices and the two U.S. senators are Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
So by just because of that alone, it would be the most progressive. I'm not saying that, you know, Mark Warner's particularly progressive as a Democrat.
Right.
You know, within the Democratic Party, he's actually one of the more conservative Democrats. But he's still a Democrat, and it's a lot more progressive than, let's say, North Carolina's two senators or Georgia's, you know, who are.
You also voted for Barack Obama twice, you know. So,
right. And what the other thing with Virginia you got to keep in mind is that the presidential election electorate is quite different than the off-year electorates. The presidential electorate, when everybody turns out to vote in Virginia, then you get all Latinos, African-Americans, Asian-Americans, you know, young people, et cetera, et cetera. All the groups that formed that Obama coalition, then we win pretty handily by 4 points, 5 points, whatever. But when they don't show up in the midterm elections, or in Virginia, we have these wonderful odd year elections, like this year, our entire General Assembly's up. That's a different story. Totally different electorate. Democrats tend to tune out of those elections, even though they're very important. And Republicans still generally tend to come out and vote because I guess they like to vote, which is good. You should vote in this country.
Yeah.
And they do. I mean, and,
Virginia's
kind of two states.
Yeah. So I'm going to throw it over to Catherine then. Catherine?
Yeah.
Hey, Lowell. Thanks for being on tonight. Sorry about last week. We had a little snap over here.
Yeah, that was fun.
So
an adventure.
I have to say that given everything that you just said about Virginia, I mean, I sort of feel like at the same time, like there were a lot of things in favor of Democrats happening, you know, change in demographics, you know, some Republican candidates mm-hmm. that were really, you know, distasteful. But the party had to be prepared for that, right? It's one of those things, I always say this, like, well, sure, you might not think that you'll ever win this particular seat, but you're definitely not going to win if you're not ready.
Mm-hmm.
So what was did the party, I think we've talked about this before, but so the party must have been ready so that when Cuccinelli was running, they had someone to run against him that was viable. And so I just think that it's got to be more than demographic. Like we always say in Georgia, a lot of people are like, oh, well, demographics are going to be in our favor and blah, blah, blah. And I'm always like, yeah, but demographics are going to mm-hmm. be in our favor if we're not ready. We got to be ready. We got to have our voters lined up. We've got to have, you know, plans in place so that we take advantage of those changes in demographics.
Mm.
So that's, I just wanted to say that.
Right.
But
now
I want to ask
go ahead.
About, so with the other, with the presidential, both the Republican and the Democrats, are there, is there a visibility for some of the candidates in Virginia, and how is that working out? Like, has Trump been there yet?
I mean, there's been some visibility. Trump's actually got his, I think it's his campaign manager or something like that, one of his top campaign people, is constantly appearing on this right-wing talk radio show in Virginia, the John Frederick Show. I try not to listen. I'm really not that interested in hearing this, but anyway, there's been some presence. The attorney general nominee, Republican attorney general nominee in 2013, Mark Obenshain, was named, what was it, like a week or two ago, I think, named Scott Walker's state chair, which was very interesting, because I mean, most likely Mark Obenshain, he's state senator. He barely lost for attorney general in 2013. Most people think he's going to run again in 2017 for statewide, either attorney general or governor. So anyway, he signed on with Scott Walker. So it's starting to percolate more. I guess, what was it? Ted Cruz kicked off his campaign at Jerry Falwell's old school down there, Liberty University. So you've had some, but I think the candidates are mostly focused on the earlier states at this point. I'm sure they must be building some infrastructure in Virginia, but it's not super visible yet. Bernie Sanders was here, a month and a half ago or so. 2 months ago, something like that, with our congressman up here in Arlington, Alexandria, Don Beyer. They had a joint event, and it was funny. I mean, Don Beyer was joking about, he looks out on this vast crowd, and it was vast in the sense that it wasn't 20,000, but the room was packed. There were probably 500 people in there for a discussion. It wasn't a rally. It was supposed to be a discussion of progressive ideas and whatever. And I got there an hour early because I was going to cover it. And I figured that's plenty of time, right? I walk in there, and every single seat in there was taken an hour early. Everyone was, like, eager. And so Don Beyer jokes when he gets up there. He's like, I know every one of you came out just to see me. But no, it was obviously to see Bernie Sanders. So that was in Arlington, and, you know, it was very interesting. That was an eye-opener for me. I was amazed. But it was interesting, too. Bernie Sanders got some tough questions from the audience, and including one on guns and his position on guns, because he's gotten strong, he used to at least, get very high ratings from the NRA. So anyway, that was interesting. But, yeah, so I think Virginia's going to start heating up more. But so far, it's more early maneuverings, picking, you know, state chairs of their campaigns and
right,
things like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, I think it will definitely start picking up in the next few months. I would be shocked if it didn't. So I think, oh, by the way, Bernie Sanders has announced he's coming to speak, and this is very unusual for a Democrat, to, or let alone a socialist, quote unquote, to speak at Liberty University against Jerry Falwell's ultra-conservative, you know, fundamentalist Christian college. I'm not sure why exactly Bernie Sanders.
Wow, that's weird.
It's interesting. Yeah, it's kind of odd. Maybe he feels like he's going to show that he can speak to anyone, and maybe he's going to focus on, you know, economic issues, I would think, in that audience, but he's not going to focus on gay rights and abortion. He'll get booed off the stage, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know.
He'll get shot.
So anyway, that's kind of, yeah, I mean, now we also have a former governor, Jim Gilmore, running. I think he's polling at about 0% or so, rounding down.
Yeah, he's actually been put out of
the Republican.
There's 17 candidates, and they're cutting the next debate down to 16, and he got the axe. Can I do a little follow-up on that about Bernie Sanders going to Liberty? I understand the why, because you try to convert anybody you can, if possible. I mean, if anybody's a citizen, you try to see if you can get them on your side. But the how is what I'm more interested in, because it was about 2 years ago we had a topic about Liberty University. They put the young Democrats, they said they couldn't have a club. I don't even know if there were anybody even wanting to have this club at Liberty, but they banned the idea of a young Democrat.
Yeah, there were a few.
How are the, is the administration at Liberty allowing them to come speak? Are they giving him a room? Are they inviting him? How's this working? The why is what I want to know about. Or no, I'm sorry, not the why, the how.
I haven't looked into this in extreme detail, but my understanding is he's going to be speaking at their convocation. So, yeah, I presume that means I'm sure the administration has approved of it. In fact, that apparently it was an invitation from Liberty, formally, at least. Formally, an invitation from this college to Bernie Sanders to speak there. So, I mean, I don't understand exactly what their motivation is. Not that, I would ever understand how the people at Liberty University think. I'm not the right person to ask to explain how at Liberty University think. But, Bernie Sanders, I don't know if he'll convert anyone in the audience at Liberty, but, I mean, he's speaking to a broader audience. Maybe he's trying to show that his message of on the economy really applies to everybody, I think.
Yeah.
I think this is
fascinating. I think, people need to look at it because, there's four possible reasons why they're doing this. One, Liberty's move left. I doubt it, but I guess it's possible. Liberty thinks they can hurt Hillary Clinton by promoting Bernie Sanders somehow. Probably not a lot of their students would be likely to vote in the Democratic primary. Doesn't sound right. Liberty, has decided, well, Bernie Sanders is so far outside the mainstream that he will shock any of our little naive students that might possibly vote for the Democrats because they think this guy's the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
Or fourth, they've decided they're a college and, in America, free thought and letting people be exposed to ideas and choosing the ideas they want. It's a good thing. To me, it's one of those four outcomes, and if you find out why, let us know.
Well, I just looked it up.
Yeah, well, I think we'll – yeah. He's speaking September 14th, so we'll find out – I think we'll find out a lot more soon enough, but what did you find?
You looked it up.
Well, he was invited to speak at the convocation, and Lowell had it right. He said
right.
Sanders said he would like to see if we, quote, we can reach consensus regarding the grotesque level of income and wealth inequality in our country, about the collapse of the middle class, and about the high level of childhood poverty, about climate change and other issues. They say about 12,000 people usually attendance at the convocations. And he says, it's very easy for a candidate to speak to people who hold the same views. It's harder but important to reach out to others who look at the world differently. I look forward to meeting with students and faculty at Liberty.
Yeah, I understand Bernie Sanders. We got to find out why Liberty's doing this. Maybe the purple Teletubbies
right.
is opening act. I don't know.
Well, it could be that.
Yeah, I mean, I think
it could be that they took some flack for having Ted Cruz, and they're trying to balance their guests so they don't get any, you know, additional flack for being too partisan. It could be. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, even Fox News's whole stick is like they're fair and balanced, right? So they show, even though we know it's a right wing propaganda network, basically, but they have on liberals. You know, they do. They bring on, in fact, my guy who is going to be in the Virginia House of Delegates, Mark Levine, who's a super liberal. He was just elected in a primary recently to Virginia House of Delegates. He, in Alexandria, they invite him on frequently and have over the years because they always want to get a liberal or even a very liberal view. And then they use that to somewhat knock it down. I mean,
right,
but they
exactly.
can say, see, we had both sides, you know. And that,
so
it could be. That could be part of it. And
isn't he crazy? Like, I mean,
what's that?
They sort of use it.
Yeah.
They use it
right.
like, we had the liberals on, but, you know, they're crazy. Look at what they said. They said this craziness.
So it's reason number three,
right.
if that's
and...
the case. Well, I feel like in my follow-ups, I've kind of had my question time, so I want to be fair to Tim and pass it back. Tim, more Virginia questions for Lowell.
Yeah, you've been talking a lot about Liberty University. Again, just a very few short years ago, religious conservatives led by such men as Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson used to command huge political followings in that state. Do religious conservatives still dominate the Republican Party in Virginia?
I think within the Republican Party of Virginia, what you've got is a strong, very, very strong component of it is that our religious, you know, Christian conservatives and fundamentalists. You've also got in there the Tea Party, which I think some of those people are also Christian conservatives, but a lot of them are not. And I mean, these are the people who decided to nominate what we called the extreme team in 2013 of Ken Cuccinelli, E.W. Jackson, okay, as lieutenant governor. E.W. Jackson, I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
This guy almost makes Ben Carson look moderate. I mean, it's like,
oh, yeah.
or Ted Cruz look moderate.
Talk about that guy a lot.
So, and then Mark Obenshain, who's great idea that he's probably most famous for in his career in the Virginia Senate, was to make miscarriages a criminal offense reportable to the police by women. They had to report it to the police within 24 hours, or it could be a criminal offense, basically. Okay, that's his. So this shows you how. So these are the people who they nominated in 2013. So this is a combination of, yeah, I think the it is at a convention now, and a convention has only a few couple thousand people. It's not the whole electorate, let alone the whole, I mean, or the Republican electorate, let alone the whole state electorate. But the so these are the most, you know, conservative. And if you and I followed that convention closely, I listened to hours of it. It was a Tea Party, you know, very also a lot of themes of social conservatism, whatever you want to call it, you know, anti-abortion, anti-gay, et cetera. So, yeah, I think it's that kind of coalition. You've still got, and I guess what it is, like Bill Bowling, who was the lieutenant governor, he more represents the Chamber of Commerce, the more traditional maybe country club Republicans or Chamber of Commerce Republicans. And they kind of got pushed out in that. And I don't think those people wanted Cuccinelli, E.W. Jackson, definitely didn't want him, or Obenshain even. So yeah, I think they are still very powerful in the party here, but in the state as a whole, they can't carry an election, I don't think, on their own. I mean, there's no way. In fact, if they nominate the candidate, I think it gives Democrats a better shot of a good shot of winning. You know, in the general election, that's their problem. I mean, the in the party themselves, in the Republican Party, those forces dominate, but in the general election, that doesn't serve them very well. And you know, seeing that at the national level too. So that's fine with me in a way as a Democrat. I mean, I'm happy if they want to self-destruct.
Go
right to it, guys.
Yeah. And with that, let me throw it over to Catherine right quick. Catherine?
Oh, I'm going to give it to David for the final moments, I guess.
All righty.
Okay. Well, Lowell, we got about 4 or 5 minutes tops, and we wanted to hear about congressional redistricting, because we heard, even though it's not quite time to do redistricting, we saw on your site that there's some moves in Virginia, like, I guess, Florida, too. Tell us about that.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was a crazy week, actually. I actually thought we'd get to this earlier, because we could talk about this for a while, but I guess I'll just make this briefer. But on Monday, there was a special session of the Virginia General Assembly that the governor had called, because we're under court order here in Virginia to redraw our congressional districts by September 1st to submit new maps, because the district in the, specifically the 3rd congressional district, down in the Hampton Roads area, which is like overwhelmingly African American. Okay. It was challenged in court that violated basically the 14th Amendment. And because it packed African Americans into this district and then of course dilutes their influence everywhere else
right.
in the state. And the courts have ordered Virginia to come up with new maps, and they said, yeah, those districts are unconstitutional, basically. You have to change it. So Monday was a special session, and the Democrats proposed a map or two, actually. The Republicans had no proposal. And so in the end, the legislature, this is what's really crazy. In the end, they didn't adopt any of the maps. Well, they certainly weren't going to adopt the Democratic maps because the House of Delegates is overwhelmingly Republican and the state Senate is a slight edge to the Republicans. But they ended up, the Senate adjourned without adopting anything. The House of Delegates, which is overwhelmingly Republican, claimed they didn't adjourn and that the Senate had no right to adjourn without the House agreeing to them adjourning. And so they're claiming this whole thing, everything's unconstitutional. and meanwhile, in all that, another thing got caught up in it was Governor McAuliffe had issued a recess appointment of a judge to the Virginia Supreme Court, and the Republicans are claiming that's unconstitutional. That whole thing's unconstitutional too, because supposedly that recess appointment is supposed to expire X number of days after the, I think it was 30 days, I guess, after the General Assembly meets again. So they're claiming she is an illegitimate Supreme Court justice. So we don't know how this is going to play out. I mean, this could be that this is crazy. That's why I was like, 4 minutes? Okay, well, this is, it's a mess. And it was quite entertaining on one level to watch, but crazy. And nobody knows how this is going to play out at this point going forward. This new justice on the Supreme Court, they're going to start issuing opinions at some point, or, you know, decisions. And what are the Republicans going to say? They might say it's illegitimate because she's not really a Supreme Court justice. And so if it's a 5-4 decision or whatever, they're going to, and she voted in the 5, they could say, well, that's not, we're never going to have to follow that or something. I mean, could they say that? And then who would decide that? The Supreme Court, which they say, this one, you know, this justice is illegitimately on there. I don't know. It's going to be very interesting. And this is all taking place in the context of we have. Sorry, go ahead.
Maps by September 1st, 2016. I mean, 2015.
No, this September 1st.
Right.
Yeah, like in a week.
Whoa.
Yeah. So probably what's happening now, I think it's going back to the courts. And probably the courts will draw new congressional districts for Virginia, which is like, wow. I mean, they could completely redraw our congressional map in Virginia. Republicans now hold an 8-3 majority in the House of Representatives in the Virginia delegation, even though it's a 50-50 state at worst for Democrats, because they've gerrymandered it. That could all be now they've basically sent it to the courts. And I guess the courts can do a totally nonpartisan redistricting of Virginia, and Republicans could lose 2 or 3 seats or whatever in 2016. It's going to be fascinating.
Well, and you could also have a lot of swing districts, which would be good for you, because races where the outcome is not known the second the districts are drawn are good for political bloggers and political blog talkers, right, Lowell?
There you go. Certainly when you have districts that are overwhelmingly one way or the other, it's not very interesting, except in the primaries maybe, where you have a Tea Party challenge the incumbent Republican or something like that. But yeah, in the general election, they're safe. They're drawn as incumbent protection districts, so they're drawn to be safe for the incumbent. Yeah. So yeah, it's boring.
What?
And that's how
parties move so far to the right or the left, is because when you just have these districts, they're so one-sided. I mean, that's how the Tea Party movement has grown. I think if there were a lot more competitive districts, those Republicans that are bemoaning the fact that the party's kind of moved away from them, that wouldn't happen. And, I mean, they could say, hey, on the other side with very Democratic districts could be the same way, too. The middle, however big that may be, and there's a lot of dispute on that, you know, kind of gets left out because the way that things get decided in the primaries, and it's, you know, run to the polls, if you will. Yeah. Well, Lowell, you aren't kidding.
Right.
I think,
and then for the voters, go ahead.
Yeah. Half the topics we had planned to talk about, we didn't get to. So we'll have to have you on sooner than later to get into some of those other things like that. Christopher Newport University, you turned us on to their polls. They had a fascinating thing. We didn't get to it. McAuliffe and Hillary Clinton's campaign didn't get to it. So we'll have to have you on in a few weeks, and we'll get to some of this, and probably 10 new things that we don't even know about today.
Exactly. Who knows? It's never a dull moment in Virginia, so it really isn't. So in politics, so yeah. But thanks for having me on, and enjoy the rest of your summer.
Thank you, sir.
Good night, everybody.
Good night to everybody. Good night, Tim. Good night, Catherine.
Good night, guys.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a